This is Cale Clark, and this is The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. Welcome back to the program. We're going to pick it up in Exodus chapter 30. And just to set the stage for you, we talked about in the last couple episodes how the priests, that's Aaron and his sons, they get special vestments to wear. We also looked at the ordination rite, as it were, of these first priests of the Old Covenant in the last chapter, chapter 29. And now we're going to look at, in chapter 30, what they actually do. And this is how they act as pontifex is, if you will. Now, the word pontifex, and we use this title for the Pope, it actually means bridge builder. And of course, priests are mediators between God and humanity. And we all share in the baptismal priesthood of Christ. We talked about that last time. But there are also ministerial priests in the Catholic Church, just as there were in ancient Israel. So let's talk about what they do. Let's read just the first few verses here, the first 10 verses of Exodus chapter 30 together. We're going to talk about the altar of incense. You shall make an altar to burn incense upon. Of acacia wood you shall make it. A cubit shall be its length, and a cubit its breadth. It shall be square, and 2 cubits shall be its height. Its horns shall be of one piece with it. And you shall overlay it with pure gold, its top and its sides round about, and its horns, and you shall make for it a molding of gold round about. And 2 golden rings you shall make for it under its molding on 2 opposite sides of it shall you make them, and they shall be holders for poles with which to carry it. You shall make the poles of acacia wood, and overlay them with gold. And you shall put it before the veil that is by the Ark of the Covenant, before the mercy seat that is over the covenant, where I will meet with you. And Aaron shall burn fragrant incense on it. Every morning when he dresses the lamps, he shall burn it. And when Aaron sets up the lamps in the evening, he shall burn it a perpetual incense before the Lord throughout your generations. You shall offer no unholy incense thereon, nor burnt offering, nor cereal offering, and you shall pour no libation thereon. Aaron shall make atonement upon its horns once a year with the blood of the sin offering of atonement. He shall make atonement for it once in the year throughout your generations. It is most holy to the Lord. Okay, so there's a lot of things going on there. Obviously, the acacia wood overlaid with gold. We've seen this time and time again. The horns of the altar, the cereal offering. I don't know whether that's Fruit Loops or Frosted Flakes, but no, I'm only kidding. But there's cereal offerings. And it says, Aaron shall make atonement in verse 10 upon its horns once a year. And what that really is the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. So let's just chat about this just for a moment before we move on to the temple tax, the very famous temple tax. But we'll get there in a second. So this altar of incense was probably put in the holy place just in front of the parochet curtain, right in the middle of the room. And in the book of Numbers, it talks a little bit more about it in the book of Numbers chapter 8. It actually says there that the light from the menorah, candelabra, shines right onto the altar of incense. Now, Dozeman in his commentary talks about how the altar is sort of symbolizing and was shaped and constructed to almost be like a rooftop. Now, why is that the case? Because there were rooftop offerings in the ancient world, in that part of the world, the ancient Near East. It was called the roof ritual. And in a lot of different religions, essentially people would make offerings on the tops of their homes, on the roof, which kind of makes sense. You're offering to the heavens above. And that's really the shape of it. That's what it's all about. And later on, when the temple is built, we can see this in 1 Kings chapter 8, the temple has an altar just like that. And so there are all kinds of altars in the ancient world that have been dug up, and some of them have been in modern-day Israel at Megiddo, Dan, Tel Dan, and Beersheba. You'll find examples of these altars. Very, very similar to this four-horned altar of incense. And so this idea of the Day of Atonement, says here in verse 10, Aaron shall make atonement on its horns, the horns of the altar, once a year from the blood of the sin offering. And once a year, he shall make atonement on it throughout your generations that is most holy to Yahweh. So this really concludes the instructions here for the altar. And the incense that is offered daily by the priest, by Aaron and his sons, that symbolizes again the glory cloud of God. Now remember when Moses went to the mountain in chapter 24, it says the cloud covered it, the glory of Yahweh settled on Mount Sinai. So this idea of the glory cloud is very much symbolic of the Holy Spirit, and this is why in a lot of Christian churches and the Orthodox churches of the East, as well as in some Eastern rites of the Catholic Church, when the consecration happens, the Eucharist, there is incense that is employed, and that again is a sign that God is here. The presence of God is here. The glory of God is now with us. And so on the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur, you can read about this, what actually happens there in Leviticus chapter 16. But we've already seen in the last chapter here in Exodus how the high priest, part of his equipment, part of his uniform, if you will, his vestments are these bells that were like pomegranates that were placed around his ankles. And this was so that they could hear him. He was the only one who was in the Holy of Holies. And if he's walking around, if you can hear the bells, you know he's still alive. If he makes a wrong move, he could be struck down, and then they'd have to drag him out by a cord that was tied around his ankle. Now, in all the historical writings that we have, there is no account of that ever actually happening, of a priest being zapped, if you will, and having to be dragged out dead. It hasn't happened that we know of, but at any rate, that's why that was there, is for the Day of Atonement. And so only the high priest, and only on the Day of Atonement can this happen. The impurity of the people is purged on the altar of incense. And the blood of the bull, the blood of the goat on the Day of Atonement acts as Dozman says, like detergent. It cleanses the people. And so, again, read more about that in Leviticus chapter 16. Now we get to the temple tax. And this is really interesting because there's a certain section in the Gospel of Matthew where it talks about Jesus and Peter and the temple tax. It's a very famous account, and we'll get to that in just a second. But let's see what it says here in Exodus chapter 30. Let's read it together, starting with verse 11. It says, "The Lord said to Moses, 'When you take the census of the sons of Israel, then each shall give a ransom for himself to the Lord when you number them, that there be no plague among them when you number them. Each who is numbered in the census shall give this, half a shekel according to the shekel of the sanctuary.'" The shekel is 20 gerahs. "Half a shekel as an offering to the Lord. Everyone who is numbered in the census from 20 years old and upward shall give the Lord's offering." Now listen to this. This is intriguing. Verse 15. "The rich shall not give more, and the poor shall not give less than the half shekel, when you give the Lord's offering to make atonement for yourselves. And you shall take the atonement money from the sons of Israel and shall appoint it for the service of the tent of meeting, that it may bring the sons of Israel to remembrance before the Lord so as to make atonement for yourselves." So this is the famous half shekel temple tax. I want you to know that this has nothing to do with animal sacrifices for the sins of the people, this half shekel. And really what this is all about is keeping the tabernacle going. It's financially supporting the tabernacle, the work of the priest, the structure. It's a lot like the offerings that we make in our local Catholic parishes to keep the building going, keep the upkeep. And so this later on becomes a temple tax when the temple is constructed in Jerusalem. And so obviously the second temple, the temple built by Herod, was in play when Jesus was walking the earth prior to his resurrection ascension. And we'll talk about that and how he dealt with the temple tax in just a minute. But this half shekel, by the way, a shekel here, it's a unit of weight. It's not necessarily a coin per se, but it's a piece of silver that weighs a certain amount. In fact, to be exact, it's 11.4 grams according to Sarna, who's one of the major commentators on Exodus. So it is silver. And don't forget, remember we talked about all the colors of the tabernacle, the tent of meeting. Silver, remember, is the color representing redemption. Redemption. And every single Israelite male needs to be redeemed. Now, specifically, the reason why this is happening is a census is being taken. You need to know how many people are there. And specifically, even more specifically, this is a census about how many males 20 years of age and older are in Israel at this time. Now, why would they need to just count the males 20 years of age and older? Because these are men of fighting age. In other words, this is what you would do if you were trying to assemble an army or you're trying to figure out, do we have an army? How many guys do we have to fight against our enemies? And by the way, we actually know how many of the guys there were, according to the scriptures here, 603,550. Now we see this later on in Exodus chapter 38, verse 26, where it says, in the census from 20 years old and upward, all the males, there were 603,550 men. Now, a lot of people argue about whether this is an actual literal number. These are the actual number of 20-year-old guys and older in Israel. Was it really over 603,000? It could also be what we call gematria. It could be a symbolic number because this is an enormous number. And it may well be the case. It may well be the case. This is supposed to help us see that God has been faithful to his promise to Abraham as well. Remember, the Israelites became they multiplied, were exceedingly fruitful in Egypt. And that's why the Egyptians partially were so scared of them. But this is exactly what God promised to Abram, who became Abraham, when he first called him back in Genesis chapter 12. It says, "Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who curses you I will curse, and by you all the families of the earth shall bless themselves." So this idea that the fruitfulness promised to Abram is actually happening. This, God has been faithful to his promises. And so when they left Egypt back in chapter 12, they were described as a host. I mean, that's a word that's used for an army. In chapter 13, Israel was called an army in five parts. So they were kind of, even as they were traveling, arranged almost in military companies. So there's a lot of military language here, and this is probably why they took the census. Now, the reason why they have to give this offering is not just to support the tabernacle, make sure that the curtains are nice and all that stuff, but they also have to redeem themselves. They have to give an offering to God. Why? Because God does not like it when his people throughout the Old Testament, when they try to set up an army or take a census, and he was mad at King David for doing this later on, back in further on in salvation history in 2 Samuel 24, God thought it was sinful that David counted the people, took a census. Why? In fact, he kind of had to be punished for this because God didn't want his people Israel waging war against their enemies the same way that all the other nations did, because everybody else looked at the numbers. How many guys do they have? How many do we have? What kind of weapons do they have? What kind of weapons do we have? Can we actually win this war? But God says, it's not going to be by military might that you will prevail. It will be by my spirit, by my will. In fact, I'm going to fight for you. If you let me, I will fight for you on your behalf. You can't do this on your own. You can't turn from trust in me to your own resources. And that's a good lesson for us in life as well, that many times we want to trust in our own cleverness, our own resources, which God himself has given to us, all the gifts that we have. But we think that we can do it without him. We think that we can pull off great victories in the spiritual life without God's help and his grace. And we fall flat on our face whenever that happens. We give in to a temptation. We lose the battle. And then we say, man, we should have turned to God before. We should have turned to prayer first of all. We should have trusted in the grace and power he pours out in the sacraments. And it was the same way in ancient Israel. In 2 Samuel 24, David, the entire nation are punished because they didn't trust God. So this is why they have to give the half shekel, to redeem them. And it's a way of saying, God, you really should be punished for this attitude, but God is going to pay the ransom. He's going to get you out of spiritual prison, if you will. And that's one of the reasons behind. But again, it was also for upkeep. And we see this, of course, later on with Jesus. Now, this is what happens in the Gospel of Matthew. I just want to talk about this for 1 second. Now, it's also interesting, like I said before, that the amount is the same for rich or poor alike. Every human life is of infinite value in God's eyes, and the price to redeem each person is the same. And of course, ultimately, it was the blood of Jesus Christ who redeemed all of us. So let's look at Matthew chapter 17, starting with verse 24. It says, when they came to Capernaum, the collectors of the half shekel tax, that's the temple tax, went up to Peter and said, does not your teacher pay the tax? He said, yes. And when he came home, Jesus spoke to him first, saying, what do you think, Simon? From whom do kings of the earth take toll or tribute? From their sons or from others? And when he said, from others, Jesus said to him, then the sons are free. However, not to give offense to them, go to the sea and cast a hook and take the first fish that comes up. And when you open its mouth, you will find a shekel. Take that and give it to them for me and for yourself. I just love this passage for many reasons, but it's interesting that the religious authorities, they go right to Peter. They know who the leader of the apostles is, and that's important for us to know. This is part of the biblical evidence for the primacy of Peter in Matthew's gospel. And they ask him, hey, does your teacher pay the tax? And you kind of get the sense that Peter probably doesn't know the answer, but he's trying to stick up for Jesus. He said, yeah, of course he does. But he doesn't really know for sure. At least I hope he does. So when he comes back to the house in Capernaum, which is probably in all likelihood Peter's own house, and you can actually see the ruins of it if you go to Capernaum today. He doesn't even have to say it. As soon as he walks in the door, Jesus talks to him first. He knows exactly what's going on. And this is part, again, of the divinity of Christ, that he has absolute knowledge of everything. And he knows, even though he wasn't there, what happened. And this is, I love that as well. But Jesus says, what do you think, Simon? From whom do kings of the earth take toll or tribute? From their sons or from others? And Peter says, well, from other people. They don't charge their own kids taxes. If you're a king, you're part of the royal family, then you know you kind of spend the tax money. And Jesus says, you're right. You're right. The sons are free, but so we don't really have to pay this temple tax. Why? Because I'm God in the flesh, but we don't need to do this. We don't need to pay, but we're going to do it anyways. We're going to do it anyways because we don't want to give needless offense. We're not going to ask for special treatment. And when we do this, it might help people to understand the legitimacy of our cause. And in the same way, this is why a lot of Jewish Christians in the beginning who are trying to reach their fellow Jews with the news that Jesus was the Messiah, they even though they didn't need to adhere anymore to the kosher food laws, they did anyways because they knew that their fellow Jews wouldn't take them seriously if they didn't. We're talking about James, the relative of Jesus, and many others. However, this miracle happens. Peter goes fishing. The first fish he catches, again, a sign of the divinity of Christ here. This is a miracle. Opens up the fish's mouth, and there is a shekel. And that is enough to pay for Jesus and Peter. Half shekel each, one coin. And this is, again, the unity of Christ with his vicar, the first pope, Peter. If you're hearing from Peter, you're hearing from Christ. And so it's just a beautiful, beautiful passage, and it really does shed some light on this half shekel temple tax, which at the time was for the tabernacle, because the temple had yet to be built. We're going to continue with Exodus in the next episode here on The Faith Explained, but right now, it's time to open up once again The Faith Explained Q&A mailbag. Let's go. Okay, as we open up our mailbag today, today's question comes to us from Alan in Las Vegas. And he asks, hi, Cale, have the books of the Bible been preserved well over time? Or Have they been distorted through the years? That's a good question. And the answer is yes, they have been incredibly well preserved. Before we get talking about this, I want to mention the work of the scribes. Now, there are some scholars out there, such as Bart Ehrman, who has bona fide credentials as a scholar. He questions the text of the Bible, specifically the New Testament. Can you trust it? He says scribes have made hundreds and maybe even thousands of errors in the text as they've copied. And he is right about that in a certain sense, but none of these errors are in any way affecting any major doctrine of the faith. A couple words might have been missed here or there, but nothing of consequence. There's no teaching of the faith or dogma of the faith that's in question here. And in fact, a lot of times these scribal changes in the manuscript copies of the New Testament, people would insert, monks and other scribes would insert Christ after Jesus or something like that. These are materially not a problem. Now, let me just talk about the work of the scribes in general. And this even is noted in Old Testament times, like the book of Jeremiah mentions Baruch. Baruch was a scribe who actually wrote down the words of Jeremiah, and he put them really into a manuscript so that other people could read them. And we know that even in the New Testament, St. Paul hired a professional scribe. I don't know if you know this, but this is mentioned in several places. Let's look up Romans chapter 16, verse 22. And actually, the scribe kind of inserts himself into the text a little bit. In Romans chapter 16, verse 22, we see this. I, Tertius, who wrote down this letter, greet you in the Lord. So he kind of puts himself in the Bible. Not bad, not bad. So Tertius was the scribe that St. Paul hired. Now, Paul just kind of kicked back in a lounge chair and just kind of dictated Romans, and Tertius wrote it down. And we see this elsewhere in the New Testament as well. But that's not a problem. That's not a problem for us as well. And so what would have happened there would have been this: Tertius would have had the autograph, what's called the autograph, the original copy of St. Paul's letter to the Romans. And maybe he made a second copy out of that. He just, before he sent it off, one to keep, one to send along to Rome. That's what scholars think today. There might have been more than one original copy of a biblical book in the New Testament. So the way that this kind of worked through salvation history, Old and New Covenant, scribes were very, very conscientious, especially in the Old Covenant time, about making sure that they did as perfect a job as possible transmitting the text, making copies of the biblical books. Now, this is not just them trying to maintain their professional prestige as scribes and do a really good job at a human level. They were believers too. They were believers in the one true and living God, and their faith came through in a lot of ways. Scribes would break their pens every time they wrote out the divine name, the name of God, Yahweh, or the Lord. They would break their pen after writing that down, so it would never, once it's used to write the name of God, it can never be used again. So they went through a lot of Bic pens back in the day. Some of them weren't using Bic pens, of course, but having said that, They really wanted to ensure that the integrity of the text came through. What they would do also sometimes is that when Old Testament manuscripts would start to get worn out, they would actually discard them. And archaeologists have found a lot of what they call geniza, which are graveyards for texts. Like some of them are biblical texts, some of them are other holy writings, and they'll find these rooms where they retire these manuscripts after a while. Now, in terms of the New Testament, we have over 5,700 manuscripts of the New Testament. So it's very easy to actually reconstruct what the original text would have said. You just simply compare the manuscripts to each other, and you can figure out what the original reading was if there's ever a question of what is being said. Now, think about this. 5,700 copies, a little bit more than that, of the New Testament manuscripts have been discovered through archaeology. Only 700 copies, less than 700 copies of Homer's Iliad have ever been found. Josephus, the great Jewish historian, nobody really questions his work. There have only been 9 copies found of his massive work known as the Jewish Wars. And nobody really doubts that These are legit, but there's only 9 copies. We have so many more copies of the New Testament books. Overwhelming evidence for the accuracy of these texts. Now, the Old Testament was really cool about the Old Testament. A great find that buttressed our confidence in the Old Testament manuscripts was, of course, the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls in 1947. I think the greatest find of the greatest archaeological find of the 20th century for sure, and I think the greatest of the scrolls that were discovered is what's known as the Great Isaiah Scroll. Now, this was found in cave number 1. There are all these different caves that were found. In cave number 1, the desert region of Qumran. And by the way, the Dead Sea Scrolls, most of them are written between 200 BC and sometime in the first century, about AD 68, just before the fall of the temple in 70 AD. But this incredible Isaiah scroll, it's the most complete text that was ever found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. There's been lots of fragments of different biblical books and from the Old Testament, some other writings, but the book of Isaiah, pretty much the entire book was found, and it was 1,000 years older than the oldest copy of the book of Isaiah that was in existence at that time. A lot of scholars think it goes all the way back to 356 BC, this particular copy of the book of Isaiah. Some people think it's a little bit newer than that, but it's about 1,000 years older than the next oldest one that we have. And here's the thing, it's the exact same Hebrew text as the book of Isaiah today. It's exactly the same. It's exactly the same. This shows the absolute care that scribes took. Now, it's missing a couple of words here and there, but otherwise, it's 99.9997%. I don't know if that number is exactly right, but you get the point. It's pretty much the exact same Isaiah that we read today. So this is how careful the scribes were, and this is how confident we can really be that the biblical text was passed down accurately to us. It hasn't been doctored, hasn't been changed, hasn't been lost. We can trust it. We can absolutely trust it. Now, believing what it says is another matter entirely, but the texts that we have of the Old Testament books and the New Testament books are legit. So great question from Alan in Las Vegas. And if you have a question for me, you can write it in to faith@relevantradio.com. That's the email address, faith@relevantradio.com. Or you can send me your question on Twitter. Follow me at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E Clark with an E. Thanks for listening to The Faith Explained today. I'll be back tomorrow at 12:30 Central Live, where you can catch the podcast. And later today, as I am every evening on Relevant Radio, 5 p.m. Central, The Cale Clark Show. We'll also see you there for my show, and you can call in and talk to me there. God bless you. Take care. Peace.